Session number 918.
Colonel Wigan, Reel 1. Do you come from a military background?
Yes, I do. My father was a soldier. He was a brigadier, and he commanded a cavalry brigade in the First World War, mainly in Egypt and in Gallipoli.
Did he talk very much about the cavalry experience of the First World War?
Yes, I think he did, because I think he always knew I was going to be a soldier. So we used to have, you know, quite a lot of discussions, really, about it, you know. And that's really what made me always want to join the army, really.
What did he see from your recollections of those conversations about the cavalry rail?
I think he was a great believer in those days, of course, of the cavalry. Being a cavalry soldier, he obviously believed in the cavalry role. And of course, it probably was a bit different for him, because he was then soldiering in Egypt, which was, of course, an open country and ideally suited for cavalry. And of course, he was working under Field Marshal Lord Allenby, who was, of course, a very keen cavalry soldier himself.
So was he disappointed, for example, in the way in which the cavalry had not had a chance of really showing?
You see, I think in the First World War, as you're aware, the cavalry never really had a chance at all in the whole war. They were always waiting for this breakthrough, which of course never came through at all. But of course they got it in Egypt, you know, when he broke through and captured Jerusalem in 1918, I think it was.
And your father was involved in that, was he?
Actually, he wasn't there. He was not there at the end. No. I think he left in 1917. I think.
But it was through him, you think, that you sort of had the idea of joining the army.
Well, I think he was. Yes, he was a cavalry soldier. I liked horses, and he liked horses. And I think he definitely installed the love of horses and being a cavalry soldier in me from probably really a very early age. Probably, I think.
No. When you were at Sandhurst, was the cavalry looked upon as having a future?
Oh yes, I think definitely. I think we were taught then, you know, that the cavalry has a role in the next war. Then I always feel a little bit, perhaps, the British Army, that you are sometimes, you haven't got over the tactics of the last war enough to look into the tactics of the next war. Of course, armour was on the target. I mean, the tank had been produced in France in 1917, 1918, at Combray and elsewhere, and I think we were beginning to think, but I don't think they really entered my head, personally.
Had your father ever mentioned the tanks at all?
No, I think he'd been probably horrified if I had.
Did he show surprise at your choice of 11th Hussars?
This is a very personal question. I think he was disappointed that I didn't go into his own regiment, which was the 13th Hussars. But at that moment of my career, I don't know really why, I didn't really want to go abroad to India then. I'd always had gone to India, but I didn't want to go to India then. The 11th Hussars had just come home from India, and I wanted to stay in England for a few years before I went abroad. I think that's probably why.
When you were at Sandhurst, did people come around sort of from the different regiments recruiting and things?
No, well, I think I was always, personally, I was very lucky. I was earmarked for the 11th Hussars, really, before I went to Sandhurst. Provided I passed out of Sandhurst satisfactorily, I think no one came to ask, because I was earmarked then by full colonel, who was Major General Pittman.
At Sandhurst, did anybody talk about mechanisation or the role that the tanks had played in the war? Do you remember that?
No, I really don't think. I don't think I can really remember this. I think certainly it must have been brought up, but I cannot remember anything very firm about it, but I'm quite certain that it was mentioned, but honestly, I can't remember. It's 50 years ago.
What was your impression when you joined the 11th Hussars? What sort of impression did they make on you?
Well, I don't think anybody spoke to me for about 6 months, which is perfectly true in those days, which I don't think was probably very bad for one, but it was a bit odd at times. And but I thought they were all, personally, I was very lucky, really, because I had a lot of friends there who'd been at school with me, and therefore they made me really quite welcome. But one was treated pretty rough, and one had to go through riding school again. I had to go learn how to shoe a horse, and I had to go on the square, which was drill. I had to do everything, really, which I had done at Santa. So it was quite tough in those days, and people were not very friendly for a bit. Once they thought you were reasonably okay, well, then they accepted you, I think.
But there was this sort of business of breaking yourself in.
You were broken in, Santa. Oh, yes. No nonsense at all. They were not... you had to prove that you were, you know, more or less a reasonable chap, I think, undoubtedly, and efficient.
Who undertook most of that instruction at the beginning, then?
Probably the backbone of the British Army, the ordinary sergeant. The sergeant taught me on the riding school, the sergeant taught me how to look after the stables, a farrier sergeant taught me how to shoe a horse, and of course the adjutant kept what I call a watchful eye on one. It was much tougher than it is now.
And did you have a set number of troopers to look after?
No, you had a troop. I think you had about 30 horses and 30 men. When you joined a certain squadron, and you had about 30 troopers, and you commanded a troop in that squadron, which consisted of about 30 men and possibly the same number of horses.
What sort of exercises were you doing when you did the training exercises?
Well, you see, really, I was only there myself under one year, really, as a horse soldier. And when we went out on manoeuvres, as we did the first year I joined, which was 1927, we were used, of course, as the armoury is now, we were used entirely on reconnaissance, really, or waiting for breakthrough, which never ever came. But we were really purely a reconnaissance role, I think, then.
That was an advance.
In advance, finding out where the enemy were, finding out what the strength of the enemy, finding out if there were any enemy in the areas, finding out bridges or such places were held by the enemy. It was purely reconnoitering in those days.
And when you'd found that, how would that be relayed back then to...?
Somebody had to ride back and tell them. There was no wireless, nothing like that. You sent a message back to the regimental headquarters, and the regimental headquarters sent another one back to the brigade headquarters, but in those days we had no mechanised transport at all. We were just beginning to get the odd mechanised lorry in order to carry up the spares for the horses and shoes and fodder and those. But it was all a very slow process. There were no wireless.
When you mentioned those manoeuvres, which arm were you sort of closely working with mainly? Was it infantry?
Yes, of course, you worked as what they call divisional, I think, probably as divisional troops, really. There was it's a little difficult, yes, because the cavalry brigades, again, in the First World War, were very split up, of course, and half of them were dismounted and put on their feet. But when we went as cavalry brigades, we were there, as I've originally said, either to reconnoitre or to be kept in reserve as an armed force if there was breakthrough, so we could pursue the enemy as such.
Would you say that you came across, or in the discussions of tactical things, any influence of what had happened to cavalry in the First World War? Had they changed their ideas much?
No, I don't think so at all, except, of course, in the First World War, there was never a breakthrough at all. I mean, they were occupied, as I repeated, in my father's case, in Egypt. They were used in Mesopotamia, where they got into trouble, of course, where most of them were captured, because they ran out of water half the time. But I don't think the taxes really changed at all since what I call they hoped would be the cavalry reserve to exploit success if those would break through.
Did you, in those days, was the tank corps seen as any kind of threat to that sort of cavalry reconnaissance rail?
I don't think we ever thought about it.
It was not discussed at all?
I don't, no, because the tank corps was not a reconnaissance regiment as such, really. The tanks were not reconnaissance troops. They did have an armored car regiment or two, which I think were used as reconnaissance, but not really in the last war at all. They only really were used in Egypt. But I don't think they came into, as far as I remember, really came into our lives at all, to be honest.
You didn't discuss the fact I want to see the armoured car, for example, as being a threat or...?
I don't think so at all. Not then. Not until we were really mechanised. And then we realised that it's potential then, I think.
On the individual training basis, what were you training? Any sort of musketry training or...?
You mean before we mechanised?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Oh, there certainly. I think we were really probably one of the best musketry regiments as such, because we still had to learn to shoot. I mean, I think that was most important. Every man had to learn to shoot, because we really, except being armed, you know, we were armed with a sword and we were armed with a rifle. So he had to learn to shoot. And I think we as a regiment then, people realised how important it was that a chap had to learn to shoot. Oh, very much so. We were very strong then, and we used to win quite a lot of cups in Bisley and all these army rifle meetings that went on in those years.
He was trained, in other words, to shoot when he was dismounted?
Oh, definitely, yes. Yes, we didn't gallop along like a cowboy firing from the hip. That's all of it, a myth. We got off our horse and we advanced and then we shot.
What was the general tactics for that cavalry then when you advanced and you'd come across some enemy that you could engage straight away? Was the idea that you were to get off and...
The idea is the old cavalry charge disappeared. There were one or two cases in Egypt, there was one or two cases in Mesopotamia. In fact, my father's brigade, I think, did the Worcestershire Yeomanry charge, a place called Hughes, H-U-J, which was one of the last, I think, cavalry charges, really, of the World War. I believe they said the Poles did charge the tanks in Poland in 1939, but that was rather a vain effort. But I think we really seldom thought ourselves as being able to really draw swords and charge. I think we realised that we had to fight. Because to get information, to get reconnaissance, you had to fight, obviously. I mean, you couldn't, but you didn't get heavily involved, you know, because you had too many horses, you know, you couldn't get involved. Probably you were rarely reconnaissance. But you had to learn to shoot in order to get involved, to find out the information. I think that is probably true.
So would you say that for the using horses, this was ideal, was it? I mean, horses were very good for that sort of role.
Yes, of course. We can move much faster across the country. If necessary, the horses could, up to a point, live off the country, provided there was water about, you know, there's plenty of grass in most countries. And I think, you know, they were mobile and could obviously travel much quicker and go across country where the ordinary infantryman could not do on his feet.
So it wasn't just sort of sentiment, in other words, then, that kept you attached to horses?
No, I think the sentiment was I'd been brought up with horses and I liked horses for the sake of horses, not necessarily for the sake of the army. Really.
When did you first hear of anything about mechanisation? When did this sort of crop up at all? Did you hear any rumours that you were likely to be mechanised?
I can't remember this. I think I did trying to think this one over. I can't really remember that we really discussed it much before we were told. I don't think that there could have been rumors in the air, but I don't believe we really paid any attention to looking back on it now. And until our colonel came down and told us that order shot, I think one rather felt it would never happen to us.
How was that done? How did this sort of news then break?
I can remember now myself that the colonel came down to the officer's mess when we were stationed at Aldershot. I think it was whether before lunch or after lunch, I think it was before lunch. He had us all in the anteroom in the mess and told us that as we were the two unamalgamated, you must remember that all the other cavalry regiments had been amalgamated by then, as we were the only two unamalgamated junior cavalry regiments, that the war officers decided that the 11th Hussars and the 12th Lancers should be mechanized. And that was how we were told.
Who was this that gave this information?
This was our full colonel, Major General T. Pittman.
So you realized something quite serious was up when you saw him, did you?
Well, I suppose, we were a little surprised. We didn't know quite what he'd come to talk to us about. Of course, full colonels did come down to see the regiment, obviously, because they were interested and they wanted to see how we were all doing. But I don't think I really can't remember whether we thought there was something in the air or not. We obviously thought there must have been something up, otherwise he wouldn't have bothered to come down lunch, probably, really.
Well, what was the reaction to that?
Well, I think, as I said, of horror. But I think we thought, as I just said, this would never happen to us. But to add to this, which may be your next question, of course, is I think he pointed out to us that we were getting in on the ground floor and that this would eventually happen to all cavalry regiments. And the colonel and the lieutenant colonel, who was then Sutton, who was then commanding the 11th Hussars, I think he said to us, either we all go or we all stayed. And at that moment, we all stayed. And I remember, as he was then, Captain John Coombe, who eventually became a major general, having been commander of the 11th Hussars in the war and then a prisoner of war, then he had a division in Italy. I think he said, how lucky we probably are, because now we should be able to dictate our own terms for this mechanization.
That was immediate reaction, was it?
I think so, yes. Well, I'd say probably after we'd had a couple of gin and tonics after the general had gone, you know. Probably. But I think it was a shock to us. You know, we had all joined the cavalry regiment. I mean, whenever you join, you don't expect to be turned into something else practically the next day. And of course, a lot of them had been in the regiment a long time. And I think it was a shock to them. But I think as a younger one, we probably realised after a time that it was probably going to happen to us. If rape is inevitable, you want to relax and enjoy it, as they say.
Did you in any way see signs of resistance to this? Were there people who said, well, that's it, I'm not staying?
No, at the moment, I don't think anyone actually, as an immediate result, as far as I can recollect, no one left at all. I think probably within the year, some of the older ones did leave, I think, because they were older, they were probably due to leave the army fairly soon anyway. But the younger ones, I think probably one did leave probably after a year, because he really didn't want to go on, I think. But with the time of the we were told we mechanized, I can definitely say no one left immediately at once. But I think some of the older ones did leave, who'd been in the First World War. They didn't want to, they were too old really to get to understand what I call the mechanics of mechanics, you see what I mean.
When you were told this, were you told that you'd be going into armoured cars? They gave you that information.
Oh, definitely. Yes, we were definitely told that we would be turned into an armoured car regiment.
And did they say, well, you'll be able to have the same role tactically, or was that discussed at all at that meeting?
Oh, no, no, not at that meeting. There was nothing else discussed at all. At that meeting, we were just told we were going to be turned into armoured cars, and that was that. At that meeting. Of course, then the other thing was, you know, they evolved what I call later on, don't know, when the, you know, we got directives how we were going to be trained, what course we got to go on to, and then that all came, of course, later on.
How much later, in fact? Would you, I mean, was it a gap of, say, 7 months before you?
Oh no, we were told in March. We got rid of our horses. We had our last mounted parade in April of that year, which was 1928. And from that time, things moved very rapidly indeed. We all went on, officers went on courses, and then the NCOs went on courses. Oh no, there was no gap at all, really, absolutely none at all. We were, you know, within a month, we were beginning to be used in our new role.
Did the War Office sort of try to sort of alleviate the blow in any way?
I think, yes, I think as far as I remember, they left the regiment with 50 horses, approximately, I think. I maybe, without looking at the records, I couldn't, what I call, swear to this one. They did leave with 50 regiment. The officers were allowed to keep that charges, really, in order for really quite a long time. And we kept 50 horses, also in the regiment, for the use of the NCOs and men who wanted to go on with things like tent pegging and the things they used to hold the Royal Tournament, sword, lancer and revolver competitions. But of course, eventually we lost those too. But we didn't, to begin with, we definitely, you know, had those given to us, I think, really, as a SOP, you see.
Were there any other sort of things like that? Was that the major one?
I don't think anything else happened really at all. There was the big discussion, of course, what we should wear on our head. That was a very popular one. We didn't fancy wearing a black beret at that time. So after a lot of consultations, we were allowed to have our own beret, which was a brown beret with a red band round the bottom of the beret. And we wear it to this day.
Dress was quite an issue, was it, about what you were going to dress?
Well, I think it was, no, we were a bit choosy. You see, a lot of other regiments did the same. You see, the Scots Greys had a grey beret, and they've still got it. But we were the first to have it, you know. We were the first to be mechanised anyway. So I think people probably copied us, really. And we were allowed our red beret.
I believe you kept your boots or something, didn't you, as well?
Well, I'm not sure it's right to say we kept our boots. I think when we were first mechanised, we used to wear our breeches and boots. And I think some of us even wore our spurs. But we did find that they used to get tangled up a bit in the gearbox or something. And then we came to the conclusion that it really wasn't a very sensible dress. But I've got pictures, I think, you know, here, of myself in the back of an armoured car, in my boots and breeches, definitely. Then, you know, that was what I call tradition dies hard, and then we realised, of course, it was totally impractical to, you know, to wear a pair of breeches and a pair of boots in an armoured car. So we then took to overalls, not very willingly, but we did.
Well, you'd wear overalls when you were in the car itself?
Yeah.
What was the sergeants and NCOs' reactions to this? All
this is a question which I find difficult to remember. I know that Colonel Sutton told them, and I don't think anybody, I think the older soldiers were obviously not at all happy about it, because they had, as I said, been in the war, they were enlisted as cavalry soldiers, and in the old days, you see, people weren't really very mechanically minded, like they are now. You know, people didn't have motor cars in those days, they didn't have motorbikes. I mean, the soldiers in those days couldn't afford a motorbike or a car, hardly. On the pay he got, nor were the officers, some of them, I'm telling you. I think they accepted it. I think they were they realize they were Lemsars, and they'll know then they've got to get down to the job. I think some of them did leave, but then they were obviously would never make a mechanical soldier.
There were some who left, though, were there?
I think so, and some were posted away, you know. I think some obviously, if you were a farrier, well, you were obviously not going to be much good, you know, and spend your life showing horses for 15 or 20 years. You were not going to be suddenly turned into a mechanic, were you, probably? And they went to other regiments.
But you'd need some farriers, wouldn't you, to keep up? You had your chargers still there, so you'd need
I think one or two for a bit, yes. Oh, yes, I think there were a few, but not the full strength that we would have. I mean, but there were some people who obviously could never be a mechanical soldier.
You'd mentioned earlier on when you said you'd been larger chargers that you were also, the NCOs were kept. They had some horses as well.
Well, they were kept for the use of the NCOs and troopers, I think, because there were still a lot of competitions which went on, show jumping, and competitions of the Royal Tournament at Olympia, I don't know, and I think those were kept as a bit, you know. I can't really remember, but I think we did keep 50 horses for a bit, but without looking it up, I really couldn't remember.
Did it at all occur to you or your fellow subalterns that your army prospects as such might be affected by this, that you might get better promotion or anything like that?
I don't think, in my own case, I don't think it entered my head at all. I think probably I thought as long as I can go on remaining at a Lemsar, I don't think, I mean, one obviously wanted to get the ordinary promotion. I don't think one was, no, terribly ambitious in those days. One obviously wanted to be a reasonable soldier. And I think one really wanted to be able to stay with the Lemsars, as I say, which are very much a family regiment. A point I have made, I think, very often, really.
Would you say overall, then, just summarising that brief, the introduction to mechanisation, that it was carried out well?
I think it was carried out remarkably well and remarkably smoothly, because we really didn't know half the time what we were meant to be doing, but we got down to it, we learned what it was all about, and we started to write all the sort of armour car manuals and training directives, probably for the whole of the British Army, in that line. Oh yes, I think it went really most wonderfully well.
How long were you at Aldershot before then being sent down to Bovington? How long before you left?
I think the first lot of us went down in September. I think